Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Welcome back to the second hour of Up North News for this Thursday, October 6th. We have the chicks not ready to make nice, playing us in because our nice friend, Dr. Kristen Lyerly, is here. But there's a lot of what's not nice out there, and it's what's driving people to vote early or to turn out in droves come November 8th, especially on a topic near and dear to her heart, of course, and that would be women's reproductive health rights, which is what took her out to Washington, D.C. earlier this week. Good morning, friend. How are you?
Good morning. It's so good to be home back here with you, Pat.
I took a look at the radar because I see you're talking to us from outside out on the your back deck, it looks like, and basically, you've got about 60 minutes left of the nice side of autumn, and then it's going to get cold and blustery after that.
I live in Wisconsin, and as we know, when the weather is nice, we've got to be outside and appreciate it because things can change pretty quickly. So I'm just going to absorb every minute of it.
There you go. Yeah, there's a line that stretches all the way across the state from just west of Green Bay down to Waterloo, Iowa, and it's just barreling on through. So let's talk about this White House Task Force on Reproductive Health Rights. This was the second meeting that was called by President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris to mark 100 days since the Dobbs decision that repealed Roe v. Wade. Can you tell me a little bit more about the task force itself? What you know, how you were contacted, and what it is that the task force members are contributing to the discussion?
Yeah, the task force was created by President Biden via executive order to determine what he can do in his role in the executive branch to ensure that people have as much access as possible as we're trying to figure things out. Now that we don't have a federal standard, we've got a patchwork quilt of 50 different states that have different laws, and it's causing a lot of confusion and a lot of chaos. So this was the second meeting. And at the table, I was invited to come to the table to talk about what's happening in Wisconsin. We live here, so this is just our reality. These are our circumstances. But from an outside perspective, what's happening here in Wisconsin is truly shocking. What I heard from both the vice president and the president during this meeting, they both emphasized that here we are committed, not even committed, we are suffering under this law from 1849. And they both emphasized this was 70 years before women earned the right to vote in this country. Women didn't vote for this law, but here we are in Wisconsin living with this. So we're sitting at the table listening to both of them talk about how terrible it is in Wisconsin. And I was invited from my professional society, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, to illustrate what's happening here. And that's so easy to do because there are examples all over the place demonstrating we had a lack of access before, but it has become profoundly bad, not just with regards to abortion care, but with regards to women's health care in general.
Not to mention, when you say women's health care in general, this has never been just about abortion. And President Biden was talking about how even some colleges and universities, like at the University of Idaho, were restricting giving out information about contraceptives. And he was just aghast at that. Let's listen to what President Biden had to say.
Folks, what century are we in? I mean, what are we doing? I respect everyone's view on this, personal decisions they make, but my Lord, we're talking about contraception here. It shouldn't be that controversial. But this is what it looks like when you start to take away the right of privacy.
And I don't want to get too deep into the legal weeds here, but the whole right to contraception was based in the right to privacy, which was found in the Griswold case in the 1960s. It's what led to Roe v. Wade because of privacy rights. But now you had, even this week, the U.S. Supreme Court taking up a case about voting rights, which, again, the Voting Rights Act is rooted in part in the right to privacy. If ever there were a case that the party that used to warn us, you know, about big government is in fact being the big government that's invading all of our privacy, I don't know of a better example.
well, it's working for them. So they're just going to try to ride that momentum. Interestingly, when we were getting ready to go over to the White House, we were in the Eisenhower building next door, and we were in Hubert H. Humphrey's old office from when he was the vice president. And that was where so many of the conversations that led to the Voting Rights Act happened. And they had a big, you know, a big plaque outside that documented all of this. It was very inspirational and helped us really tie those things together. Voting, women's health, our democracy, all of these things are at stake. When our meeting was over, as President Biden was leaving, he said, I just want to say a few things before I go on to my next meeting. And I thought, okay, here's where I'm really going to understand whether President Biden really has it or really doesn't. Because of everything that we hear in the media, you just don't know. So I heard it with my own ears. He was so soft-spoken, but so determined and eloquent, as he defined this as an inflection point in history. This is a time where the decisions that we make will have an impact for the rest of our lives. So it has never been more important for us to use our voices, and our voices, for most of us, are our votes. We've got to get out and vote.
And you are using that voice to its utmost, and we really appreciate it. Dr. Kristen Lierley is with us. More on the other side of the break. First, this reminder that we'd love to keep you updated through our daily newsletter. You can sign up for it at upnorthnewswi.com. Click on newsletter in the top banner, or follow us on social media, all the usual places. I'm not dancing on TikTok yet, but someday. UpNorthNewsWI. Don't forget the WI when you search for us on social media. We'll be back.
I'm not sure I could. They say time heals.
It's time for me to take. Back now with the ever confident Dr. Kristen Lierley, talking about her time on the White House Reproductive Task Force earlier this week, and how the attacks on women's health rights will make it harder to attract and retain good physicians in Wisconsin, especially rural Wisconsin. And Kristen, as I was listening back to what you had to say, this is a point that you've made before, but it's worth repeating. This is not something that only affects women who are going to get an abortion. This is not something that only affects the patients of OBGYNs. This is going to affect the healthcare of everybody in Wisconsin. We could talk about the country, but just Wisconsin, by the sake of having this 1849 ban with its archaic language and potentially a governor and legislature that would go even further, it's going to affect everybody's quality of health care here.
Mm-hmm. We already have access issues here in Wisconsin, especially in rural Wisconsin. Two obstetrical units in northwestern Wisconsin, Barron just closed, Mayo is closing at the end of the year. Numerous other places, facilities have not been able to hire. They are at risk of having to close their facilities. Within the last 15 years, half of rural Wisconsin has lost their OB units. So when you lose your ability to deliver a baby in your community, you have to not only travel further, which means that your outcomes are worse, but also hospitals in these rural communities are often sites where people work. So it takes jobs out of our small rural communities. That affects everyone. But the biggest concern is that with this criminalization, for me to be able to provide care for my patients, doctors are wondering, is it safe for me to practice obstetrical care here in Wisconsin? Or should I go somewhere else? Because there's a need all over the country. And a number of my colleagues who practice in rural Wisconsin are ready to go. They've got their resignations ready to hand in, depending on what happens with this case.
And look, I can affirm that. We lived that. Being married to an OBGYN myself, you see the postcards that come in with all these beautiful locations. And don't think Wisconsin clinics aren't doing the same with sending out these recruiting postcards saying, you could live here, you could work here. It's what led us to live in the Caribbean for a couple of years. But again, a pretty postcard of the Northwoods of Wisconsin saying, you know, come practice in, you know, Rice Lake or Minocqua or wherever. That picture is going to mean nothing if you're worried that you're actually going to be charged or jailed by, you know, say the DA in Sheboygan County.
Yeah. And doctors know as they're looking for jobs, or the people, I talk in my testimony about a few doctors who serve in a rural community here in Wisconsin who love where they live. They love their communities. They love the service that they provide. They would never move, but they feel so threatened by what's happening here that they're considering it. And I mean, that is profoundly bad for the entire community.
The other issue among many, but again, you brought it up at the White House too. And again, it's one of those things we can't say enough because it's not out there how badly we were already doing in this country in the issue of maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. So can you explain maternal mortality and then what the situation is like right now compared to the rest of the developed world before we even get into how much worse it could get? Let's start with the basics.
It's really weird. So maternal mortality is a mom dying associated to her pregnancy. So it could be early in pregnancy related to an ectopic pregnancy. It could be at the time of delivery, or it could be any time within the year that follows her delivery in the postpartum period. And it's not unusual for moms to die in the postpartum period of a pregnancy-related issue because pregnancy doesn't end when the baby comes out. It takes a lot of time for our bodies to heal. So here in the United States, our maternal mortality rate, moms dying related to pregnancy, is the worst in the developed world. Not by a little, but by a lot. And that is despite the fact that we spend an incredible amount of money on our healthcare system, much more than any other peer country in the developed world.
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that just crazy? We spend more money on healthcare, but we're about the only one that doesn't have some kind of a national health plan. And so in a healthcare industry, it's an industry mm-hmm. run in so many large ways by for-profit insurance corporations, we have a worse maternal mortality rate than all these other developed countries in the world.
Yeah, and we know that it disproportionately affects people who live, again, in rural communities, but also underrepresented communities. A Black mom in Wisconsin is 5 times more likely to die related to her pregnancy than a white mom. And that's not because Black moms are sicker. It has to do with so many other societal issues that we have failed to deal with here in this state. We've got so much work to do. There's not a Band-Aid solution here. It's going to require some really serious, thoughtful legislative effort, some great leadership. We've got a lot of work to do, but I really feel like we can do it. And as President Biden said, this is that inflection point where people have the opportunity to stand up and say, now is the time to make that difference.
Kristen, if 2022 is going to be remembered for anything, and there will be several things, but the Dobbs decision being one of them, one of the after effects of it is how much more we talk about the specifics of women's healthcare, of reproductive health issues. And you raised the point about the 1849 law that does not have an exception for rape or incest, but it does mm-hmm. have an exception for life of the mother, but it's worded in such, you know, an old timey way almost. The language is not clear. And you've talked about how, you know, what is it, what sign are you waiting for as you're watching the condition of a patient in distress?
Mm-hmm. Politicians just seem to think it's such a clear-cut issue because they're not in it. It doesn't affect them. To them, it's just words. So there's no exception for rape. There's no exception for incest. To them, that's just like rape or incest. They're just words. To us, when someone comes in who's been raped, that's a whole thing. That's social work involvement and talking with the family and figuring out what kind of medical treatment does that person need? What kind of psychological treatment? What kind of social support? I mean, this is each one of these situations is a big deal. But life of the mother is the hardest one because pregnant people are typically really resilient. They're young and they're healthy and they hang on. They look good. Their vital signs stay stable. Their labs may be showing signs, but they're not crumping. And then all of a sudden, their body just goes, I can't do it anymore. And we have to make a decision within minutes. We don't have hours. We don't have time to get our legal counsel on board. We've got to use our best clinical judgment to make very complicated decisions for these people. And that is one of the things that the law just doesn't at all capture and couldn't have captured in 1849, because we've learned a few things about medicine since then.
I think you put it best at the meeting when you said, pregnant people don't come with a warning light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not even close. And even for us, I did 4 years of undergrad, maybe a few more. I did medical school. I did a residency in OBGYN for 4 years. I did 2 years of a master's in public health. I've done a lot of training and I have a lot of friends, people who then went on to do additional training in high-risk pregnancy and other subspecialties that all are consulted when we're dealing with some of these complicated situations. So how is it that somebody from outside of the medical field feels capable of making that decision when all of us are trying to figure out what that right time is?
And yet that does not stop them from looking and claiming that the most simplistic solutions are out there. And I'm going to tell you what one of them is. The source isn't important at the moment here, but because I'm sure we've heard it from multiple people. But when asked about, you know, what you would say to, you know, somebody in their early teens or preteen, you know, who's a victim of rape or incest and is pregnant, what do you tell them? And one of the lines that we've heard before is, well, I would tell them, you know, there are, you know, literally dozens of people who will adopt that baby for them. And Kristen, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that while you're trying to take care of a patient, there's a line down the hallway of people who suddenly want to insert themselves into this girl's life and cause even more pressure on whether to go through the pregnancy and then whether to, you know, let the baby that she delivered go to somebody else. That easy adoption scenario, I just don't think is that realistic, but maybe I'm wrong based on what you see.
It's not that easy. And we always talk about, you know, anytime that I talk with a patient who's uncertain about her pregnancy, we talk about all the options and we help them find support in whatever area they're interested in pursuing, because ultimately this is about my patient and about what the right thing is for her. But the adoption system is complicated. We need more resources there. There is no doubt. There are people who want babies and there are people who are having babies. But ultimately, we are not incubators. As in the case of rape, especially when this is a pregnancy that you didn't invite the encounter, you didn't invite this pregnancy, and now to be asked to put your own health on the line. Pregnancy is not a benign condition. To put your own health on the line, to grow a human being to then just give away. Some people would do it. Some people would feel that that was the right thing for them. But I've spoken with many people, including people who are adopted themselves, and they have taught me not to insert my own beliefs and guess what they would do in those situations. One of the most striking examples was a woman who was adopted and told me, I would never put a child through that, right before we performed her abortion together. Mm-hmm. So that's why these decisions cannot be made by me. They can be made with my counsel and sharing information, but I can't make decisions for people and neither can politicians. People have to be able to make their own healthcare decisions for themselves.
And I think that's where we'll wrap this up, is right where we started, on the whole notion of privacy. And I will again invoke Kansas and the women there who saw this as so not a partisan issue and not even a conservative versus progressive issue. There were a whole lot of conservative women out there that said this isn't anything other than a privacy issue. Is that still probably the main sentiment that's going to carry through between now and November 8th?
Yeah, I think it is now more than ever. You know, everybody's talking about freedom. I keep driving by Ron Johnson's campaign signs and they talk about fight for freedom. And I'm thinking, you're not fighting for my freedom, buddy. I want freedom. Like, we deserve to have the freedom to make our own healthcare decisions. And even on the right, when COVID was happening, they were shouting from the treetops, we need the freedom to be able to make our own decisions. My body, my choice. But apparently that only applies to you when you're in power. It doesn't apply to 50% of the population who is trying to make very difficult decisions about our reproductive history.
We don't even have the time or the ability to use the four-letter words to get into the hypocrisy over the Herschel Walker situation.
And oh my gosh.
The people who are rallying to his defense for somebody that does not want exceptions for rape or incest or even life of the mother, but he did want an exception for Herschel Walker when he felt like it.
Oh my gosh. I was listening to Ralph Reed this morning try to explain away Herschel Walker's issues. And then he came back and shamed Raphael Warnock, the preacher, for not accepting Herschel Walker's redemption story. They can twist anything.
Oh my gosh, the mental and linguistic gymnastics are just mind-blowing. Kristen, thank you for the serious conversation. I promise it'll be completely different next time, but we really need that little bit of education and motivation. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Pat. Have a great day.
All right, you too. We will be back with Kyle Kaminsky from The Gander in Michigan. You're up north.
Real information, good conversation. Unabashedly Wisconsin, you're listening to Up North News.
All right, off we go to Michigan, where you will find another one of our Courier newsroom sites. So you have Up North News here in Wisconsin, The Gander in Michigan, The Keystone in Pennsylvania, The Dogwood in Virginia, The Cardinal and Pine in North Carolina, Floriqua's in Florida, and The Copper Courier in Arizona. Many of these states having very important elections come November 8th, including Michigan, which has a contentious governor's race. And Kyle Kaminsky from The Gander is joining us this morning. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning from the more scenic side of the lake over here.
Yeah, you wish, buddy. So as you and your colleagues at The Gander have been following the races, certainly you know that in a lot of races, things are close. We're all familiar with the close margins in these Midwestern states lately, what used to be called the Blue Wall. The last I heard that in the governor's race there, the Democratic incumbent Gretchen Whitmer had what I guess you could call a comfortable lead over the Republican nominee. Her name is Tudor Dixon, if I'm not mistaken. Is comfortable the right word to describe things right now, knowing anything can happen between now and November 8th?
You know, I hate to make any kind of predictions based on what we saw in 2016, but I have to say that I think, you know, Governor Whitmer's probably feeling pretty comfortable right now. The latest polling I saw was close to a 20-point lead. Fundraising obviously at an advantage. So, yeah, I think comfortable is a pretty good word to describe it right now.
And is it a case where, and again, from outside the state, I risk overgeneralizing, but again, from what little I hear from Tudor Dixon and from some other Republicans in Michigan, I mean, the people with the loudest megaphones in the Michigan GOP are on what I believe the political scientist's technical term would be the wackadoodle fringe of the party, and that has turned off a lot of moderate voters. Again, I know I risk overgeneralizing, but I guess the more mainstream way to put it is, will the Republican Party point to what they would call bad candidates if things don't go well for them in November?
You know, it's this MAGA divide, I think this, you know, MAGA ticket across the top here is just not gaining steam among voters. And, you know, I have a few thoughts on why, and it's really from only what I can observe from going to multiple campaign events here. But there's just a real absence of any meaningful policy platforms coming from the Republican ticket right now. I mean, Dixon is still laser focused on the pandemic, businesses being closed. There's hasn't been a lockdown in Michigan in quite a long time now. Wanting to ban drag queens from schools, talking about certain books that need to be banned. These are not addressing the real issues that I think voters want to hear from, especially with 33 days to go until Election Day.
I guess that's not a big surprise. It's just interesting to hear it in another state, because here what we have by and large is a sudden explosive interest by Wisconsin Republicans in crime. I'm sure it has nothing to do with Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes potentially being the first Black U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, but be that as it may, again, it's that lack of policy. You have Governor Tony Evers, who's actually running on policy, the things he's done and the things that he is promoting. We have here a challenger in Tim Michaels, who really isn't proposing much for policy. And of course, Ron Johnson is, you know, on his own planet when it comes to a lack of policy, unless it involves, you know, horse paste or mouthwash to cure mm-hmm. COVID. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that it really just comes down to Republicans in beyond Wisconsin are having a real problem articulating policy that the average voter thinks would affect their daily lives.
No, I mean, it seems to be centered on really churning up fear among voters. I mean, at this point, Michiganders are worried about the economy. They want women to be able to make decisions about their own bodies. There's just a disconnect that I think is going to be really consequential for the Republican ticket here in November. I mean, and meanwhile, we're seeing Whitmer's campaign and, I mean, as a governor, focus on the economy, things that people are focused on. Even crime. There was a large investment in policing that was just announced within the last couple of weeks. I mean, we're just not hearing an actual game plan from the other side.
No, we're getting a lot of colorful moments, and I wanted to ask you, to talk more about this, that the Republican nominee for Governor Tudor Dixon, she has a couple of different times made light of the plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and I guess I have to ask somebody who's over there, really? Is that really what she has spent her time doing, and is that in her nature? Are we seeing somebody who is that, my words, not yours, mean that they would joke about a kidnapping plot?
There's a good chunk of the Republican side that views that entire kidnapping plot, which there were convictions of, as sort of a political scheme. And this is kind of sort of in the same vein. Our former president was here in Michigan stumping for Dixon. And that was a theme that I caught at the rally, too, is just this kind of conspiracy theory driven QAnon-esque mentality. And if it's riling up the fringe, that's one campaign strategy. But I don't think that the majority of voters are still focused on a stolen election in 2020 that there was no evidence of.
Oh, my gosh. And I'm looking at one of your stories now, you and the AP talking about some of her comments. And the story concludes saying that Dixon campaigned with Donald Trump Jr., who called the conspiracy to kidnap Whitmer, quote, the fake kidnap plot orchestrated by the FBI. Are you kidding me? I mean, this is, I hate these moments in the show where I just can't come up with the question because my jaw is too busy being down on the floor. Let me put it this way. Has there been polling about this? Is there statewide polling that would indicate that enough of a chunk of the population either doesn't believe or has doubts about the kidnap plot that would justify continuing to hit on that theme?
You know, I haven't seen any polling specific to whether or not this criminal proceeding was a legitimate one. It's kind of one of those underlying themes of the rally is there's very little to say about the candidates themselves or the platform. I mean, Trump spent all of about 90 seconds saying these candidates are awesome and then went on to trashing Biden for the other 90 minutes of his speech. There's just nothing, there's no substance to stand on. So then you turn to attacks instead.
Again, one of the more recent stories at the Gander, which, by the way, the website is gandernewsroom.com. And the headline says, Donald Trump came to Michigan for Tudor Dixon. He brought the conspiracy theories with him. And yeah, like you said, spent very little time about Michigan and fellow Republicans. I mean, he's even said in past rallies recently that he would poll better than the Republicans, really singling himself out as like not a Republican anymore. He is his own, identity. He's a one-man party, which I guess shouldn't surprise me that much. As you then pivot your coverage away from, just the horse race for governor and into issues, we certainly talk about reproductive health rights all the time here. We just finished an interview with an OBGYN, who was at the White House for a conference this week. And one of your recent stories says Michigan women fight for reproductive freedom one chat at a time. And that's a theme we've hit on here many times, is that, yeah, you can run a barrage of political ads, but it's really as many individual conversations as possible that are just as likely to, drive voter turnout and voter results. What can you tell us about who's trying to be a leader in that effort?
I mean, I think it's clear, not to bring it right back to the governor's race, but Whitmer's really leading the charge on the entire fight for reproductive freedom here. One theme that we've seen emerge from the Dixon side here is that you can separate abortion from the governor's race. And while we do have a proposal on the ballot that would cement reproductive freedom, if you have a bunch of elected officials that are actively trying to curtail those rights, it's sort of a recipe for a disaster. So at this point, I think everybody sees reproductive freedom as such an important campaign point that the side that's actively has a record of standing against it is just ready to ignore it, pretend it's not happening anymore, and move on to other less substantive topics, I suppose.
Can I switch over to the Secretary of State's race? Because again, we know the stakes involved here, that Republicans want to take state Secretary of State's offices and use them to essentially control or rig elections. And I'm looking at one of your stories about when Christina, is it Caramo or Caramo? Who's the Republican nominee? Caramo? Yep. Christina Caramo believes premarital cohabitation led to the normalization of pedophilia and bestiality, has a history of homophobic, anti-Semitic, and regressive statements, believes evolution is, quote, a fraud, and attended a conference for supporters of QAnon. That's the Republican candidate for Secretary of State. How's that race going?
You know, it's always interesting when you have an election denier who wants to run the state's elections. And that's, you know, it's going just about as dismal, I think, as the rest of the race. And it's interesting, you know, we hear a lot of these beliefs that really have nothing to do with the duties of the office. I mean, the same can be said about the attorney general's race, where there's a lot of focus on banning critical race theory from schools. I mean, the attorney general doesn't set the curriculum for public schools. So it's just kind of a trio of latching on to these non-issues, and chief among them is questioning the integrity of the election results. I mean, that's another thing that's top of mind here as we get to November, is that none of the candidates are willing to say whether they'll accept the results in November. And that's straight from the Trump playbook. So,
well, then it raises this concern, and I'm going to be asking Cam Stevenson in Arizona about it tomorrow, and we're going to talk to somebody from the Keystone in Pennsylvania next week. And in all these cases, I do want to talk about essentially the doomsday scenario. Based on the candidates there, how bad could it get? So just based on, you know, not our feelings, but on what people there actually say, if this person were to win the Secretary of State's office, Tudor Dixon were to win the governor's office, what would things look like in Michigan in the 1 to 3 years after that?
I really kind of concerned for the future of elections with, if you're not going to trust the system that's in place, then what, it could trigger chaos. I mean, that's kind of a dangerous concept to. Yeah, that's a good question. If you have the answer, give me a call.
You've got, I mean, one of the subheads in your story, you know, says what happens when election deniers run elections. And that is, when I say 1 to 3 years, I say that with a purpose, because you've got candidates who already say they might not accept the 2022 results if they lose, but if they win, they could be instrumental in influencing the 2024 election when, you know, again, it's a presidential election that's on the ballot. So I wonder if enough voters understand that these are stakes not just for this election, but for the presidential election 2 years from now.
Yeah, it's an interesting irony. It's hard to point out that there was no issue in the primary election when these folks won their races there. It's now there's an issue of doubt when it comes to the potential of losing in November. So, yeah, I know this is sort of just a wait and see one, and kind of alarming as we wait.
Yeah, I mean, some of the notes in your coverage note that, you know, if a Secretary of State got in who thought 2020 was stolen, change how elections are run. They could add requirements for mail ballot requests. They could use access to drop boxes, as has happened here in Wisconsin. They could eliminate lists of the permanent absentee voters. So, I mean, there are real life consequences for voters in Michigan based on what happens this November.
All with the theme of making it more difficult to vote, which.
Right. All right. Well, I've left this under a minute, but for folks that go over to gandernewsroom.com, it is not all like this. There's plenty to love about Michigan, said the guy whose daughter and you know, kids are in Kalamazoo. So give me in 30 seconds here the, you know, what one or two things that you really would like people to see in the Gander at gandernewsroom.com.
There really is some brighter notes on the website, so check it out. I think maybe one that would be of interest to your side over there would be our shipwreck series. Every Wednesday, we've been taking a look at shipwrecks across the Great Lakes. Turns out there are hundreds of them. So I think that series will be able to continue for a while, and we've got some great photos. And
that's great.
Stories here.
That was actually one of our most read articles, was one that we borrowed from Michigan about shipwrecks. So, Kyle Kaminsky, thanks so much. Look forward to doing it again soon.
Thanks.
All right. We'll be back after this. You're up north. We're going to talk about Ron Johnson chugging a beer in just a sec here. First, let you know, the Courier Newsroom national correspondent, Kiev Akil, joins us in our next hour. And then on Friday, we will have Mark Jacob, along with Carolyn Fiddler and Cam Stevenson from our Arizona sister publication, the Copper Courier. If you want to reach the show, 715-388-7155, or email us radio@upnorthnewswi.com. The Brewers have wrapped up their regular season, fell short of the playoffs. Now the talking begins about, you know, who will be part of the mix next year. And obviously, you know, baseball is a business. I get that. But this Garrett Mitchell kid, I see something there, I think. He's had a rocket ship path to the bigs since being drafted. He definitely took a little while to appreciate major league pitching. You know, he was below the Mendoza line for quite a stretch there, but then was really starting to find his groove. And I'm not trying to push Christian Yelich off the stage here, but much like we went from, you know, Ryan Braun to Yelich, Mitchell might be the, you know, the face of the future for the franchise here. But again, I could be wrong. You never know who's going to emerge. And much like Josh Hader or Lorenzo Cain, you never know when somebody's just going to be, you know, gone all of a sudden, but at least try to appreciate the product that's on the field while it's there. Again, because it's radio, I can't really share this with you, but a video that's making the rounds on social media shows Ron Johnson, the senior senator from Wisconsin, downing a mug of beer in like 4 seconds. And I'm not going to lie, it's not unimpressive, but it's a little bit disturbing. It's also his way of thanking the Tavern League of Wisconsin for their endorsement. The Tavern League is doing something similar to what we just talked about with Kyle Kaminsky in Michigan and Tudor Dixon. They're all still stuck in 2020. They still want to talk about pandemic shutdowns. They still want to talk about the election of 2020. There's these grievances from 2020 that for most of the world has said, move on. The taverns that weathered the storm are here. The restaurants that weathered the storm are here. Every other small business, every other unemployed person, everything was shaken up by the pandemic in an effort to save lives. And I will never not emphasize that in an almost cartoonish way, because it seems that there are still people who don't understand the point of the safeguards, of the business closures, of classes being canceled, was to save lives. We will never know, because you can't prove a negative, how many more people would have died were it not for the actions of people like Governor Tony Evers and Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Andrea Palm when she was running the Department of Health Services, and so many good people at the local levels who, you know, urged the adoption of these safeguards and who then urged people to get vaccinated as soon as a safe and proven vaccine was made available. We'll never know how much worse it could have been, how much we could have gone from a recession to an outright depression, were it not for the CARES Act, some of the other stimulus measures that were passed, and then the American Rescue Plan in 2021. And so because we can't prove that, it's easy for people to speculate and to, again, carry a grievance of something that wasn't their fault. It also, it wasn't anybody else's fault. It was that measures had to be taken, again, to keep people from dying. And so to the extent that there were businesses that did not recover of all types, taverns and restaurants and you name it, and there are plenty that didn't, it's a damn shame. But it happened. And it happened in the midst of something that we were all trying to keep from getting a lot worse. But if you're still running against, you know, Tony Evers or Gretchen Whitmer or, you know, whomever in Arizona and Pennsylvania, and pandemic shutdowns are still what you're basing it in, it seems like you're grasping at straws here, because since that time, the safeguards have been eased and then lifted. So many lives have been saved because the vaccine was out there. And there has been so much pumped into the economy to try to help farmers and entrepreneurs and families and healthcare providers and everything else. So much was pumped in that it's being blamed for inflation, even though it was actually caused by, again, a pandemic that affected the global supply chain. But it didn't stop people from saying, well, all this aid, you know, all this assistance to save the economy caused inflation. Well, you can't say there was too much money thrown at it and then still be mad that, what, not enough money was thrown at it to save a particular business here or there? So this living in the past has just got to stop. But the Tavern League made an endorsement that was not a surprise. Ron Johnson said thanks and chugged a beer in 4 seconds. I would argue against that on every level, because if there's one thing we appreciate in Wisconsin, a lot of us, it's beer. It's good tasting beer. I have a good friend who loves to take shots of Jameson and buys shots for people. And he and I know we have a pact. And that pact is that I will never take a shot of Jameson. I'm going to sip it because it's good. It is damn good Irish whiskey and should never be chugged down in one setting. And yet that's what some people would do with a whiskey. And it's what some people think is impressive to do with a beer. A beer is meant to be savored. You chug it down, you're going to want to chug another one down perhaps. And, you know, we don't want to see that kind of abuse there. So it's not that I don't appreciate the talent, but for Ron Johnson, that chugging and that endorsement is probably not quite the win that he thinks it is. Those of you who weren't here yesterday didn't get to help me formally welcome Aaron Zomers to the program. Luke Mathers is still around, but of course has his own show in the afternoon. And so as I was noting here, Aaron, that the Badgers will be at Northwestern at 2:30 Saturday afternoon. So there won't be a game there, but wondered if that's something that you take in down there, any Badger football games.
Yeah, some. I usually watch them. My roommates have gone to them, but I have had a lot of family stuff, so I haven't been able to actually go to any physically yet, but soon I hope to be able to.
You're not opposed?
No, definitely.
Okay. No, this is where we're just going to continue learning more about Aaron in little drips and drabs here. And hopefully a complete picture will emerge of whether we can talk Badger football with him or early morning grilling, as was the case in the last hour. Kia Vakil from Courier Newsroom joins us in our next hour. You're up north.